Romans chapter 10 and verse 15, the first part of it says, "And how shall they preach unless they are sent?" Well, I might ask another question, and that is, how shall they preach unless they are inspired? And inspiration for messages sometimes is difficult to come by, and I'd mentioned to Joe even as late as I think it was yesterday morning that the message wasn't coming so well. You know, my messages are definitely inspired in different ways. Some are inspired by simply the needs of the people as individuals and even nationally. Sometimes my messages are inspired by the sins of the people as I look out amongst our own people or the people of our nation. Sometimes they're inspired by current events, sometimes by questions that I receive in my correspondence, some by a scriptural passage that may just jump out at me and all of a sudden a whole message comes from that. Or sometimes simply as a result of prayer, and in some cases, when it's late Saturday, fervent prayer, when nothing else has worked. In this case, this message was inspired by an editorial in our local paper, the Scottsbluff Star-Herald, which was printed last April 20th, a article entitled, "Seeking Solutions to Prison Crowding." And I want to read at least part of what's written here. It begins by saying, "Last week's report by Governor Ben Nelson's task force on prison alternatives did nothing to solve the problems of overcrowding in Nebraska's prison system. It also didn't give Scottsbluff County officials the assurance of support they wanted before asking county voters to approve a new multi-million dollar county jail for both state and county prisoners. But the 160 report certainly did paint a bleak picture of conditions in Nebraska's correction system. Nebraska state prisons held 2,648 inmates as of October 1992, half again as many as they were designed to hold. The inmate count rose by about 1,000 in the last 10 years and is projected to do so again in the next decade." A little bit later it says, state taxpayers would have to pay about $69.2 million to build enough prison space to eliminate the overcrowding problem. They already pay about $18,345 to maintain one inmate in a Nebraska prison for 1 year. Conditions in the 26-year-old Scottsbluff County Jail are similar, says County Sheriff Chuck Fairbanks. The jail averaged slightly more than 54 inmates between January and March. It isn't supposed to hold more than 24 under current jail standards. To solve such problems, task force members say Nebraskans have only three options: build more prisons, send fewer people to prison, or release inmates more quickly. Many Nebraskans would choose none of the above, as the report acknowledges. The first means higher tax bills, at least $8 million to $9 million in Scottsbluff County's case, and the others offend common notions of justice. But if something isn't done, the report warns, neither the state nor the county may have a choice. 42 states and hundreds of U.S. local governments, including Rapid City, South Dakota, are under federal court orders telling them how many prisons to build, how to build them, and how much money to spend." The article continues, but I'll stop at that point. Now, I think probably everyone across this nation is aware that our prisons, not only in the state of Nebraska, but nationally as well, are overcrowded. Let me just share some other articles that I've accumulated in my files revealing the same thing in other states. Here's one entitled, "One in 55 Adults in Prison on Parole or on Probation." Did you catch that? One in 55 adults. And this was, by the way, in 1986. Here's part of what it says. "One of every 55 American adults, a record of 3.2 million people, was on probation, parole, or behind bars at the end of last year," the government reported Sunday. "The number of criminals out of jail under community supervision was rising faster than the number serving time in local jails and prisons," the Bureau of Justice Statistics said in its report. From 1983 through 1986, there was a 32% increase to 2.1 million in the number of probationers 18 years and older. Parolees rose by one-third to 327,000. The number of prison inmates a year ago was 547,000, up 25% from 1983. There were 273,000 people in local jails, up 23%. I'm not sure if this is national or just talking about a specific area. Nonetheless, going on, the 3.2 million adults under some form of supervision at the end of 1986 was up 7% from 1985 and up 30% from 1983, obviously a figure of nationally. And then finishing, or finally what I'll read is the last paragraph I'll read is the duration of probation and parole typically is longer than a prison term. Here's another one written in June 4th, 1990 in the Casper Star article entitled Jumpin' Inmates Outstrips New Prison Construction. Here's just a couple paragraphs from this one. Washington AP, overcrowding in the nation's jails worsened between 1988 and 1989 as construction of new cells failed to keep pace with a 15% jump in the number of prisoners, the Justice Department said Sunday. A little bit later, another paragraph, it says, on June 30, 1989, there were 395,553 prisoners held in jails operated by local governments designed to hold 367,769 people, the study said. And then one more, this one from as late as December 1992, one called Prison Stats. I'll just read some of them to you. It says at least 35% of states and the federal government are operating prisons at more than 100% of their highest rated capacity. 22 states house prisoners in local jails because there is no room for them in state prisons. On December 31, 1991, the prison population totaled 823,414. This is a 6.5% increase over the previous year and a 51% increase over the past 5 years. A little bit later, the number of female prisoners increased at a faster rate during 1990 and 1991 than male prisoners. I thought that was awfully interesting as we're in the decade of the woman. As they take the role they've chosen to take, it seems that it also includes being found in prisons more. A little bit later, it says nationwide, 599 out of every 100,000 men are in prison. For black males, the number is staggering, 3,370 per 100,000. A little bit later it says, if the rate of incarceration remains the same, the number of prisoners will equal the number of free people by the year 2053. The free people will be employed guarding the prisoners. Statistics were gathered from publications of the Bureau of Justice of Statistics, the Sentencing Project, and the Brookings Institution. Now, there's no question, I don't think in anyone's mind, that America has prison overcrowding problems. And as a matter of fact, since 1973, America has more people in prison than any other nation. From Wilmot Robertson's Dispossessed Majority on page 425, I read, the U.S. has a higher proportion of its population in jail than any other country. By the way, this was written in 1973. Again, the U.S. has a higher proportion of its population in jail than any other country, 178 per 100,000, as against Japan's 89 per 100,000, and Britain's 65, found in Simpson and Yinger, Racial and Cultural Minorities, on page 217. That's what he was quoting from in his footnote. Now, in 1993, the national average has risen to 310 prison inmates per 100,000 population. Now, that was one. I just realized that in this other one, it's even higher. The one I just read, this has it at, as a national average, 599 out of every 100,000 citizens are in prison today. So somewhere between 310 and 599 people per 100,000 are in our prisons today in America, far outweighing not only Britain and Japan, but even the USSR. America has put more people in prison than any other nation. There is no question that between 1973 and 1993, at the least, nothing has changed. There has been no solution to correct solutions under the current penal system, which have been effective in either reducing crime or reducing the resultant prison overpopulation problems. Now, overcrowding, of course, is just one of many problems that are facing the American prison systems. as a result of an inundated liberal judicial system, prison, what should be put in quotes, prison punishment is nearly negligible as one of the problems. According to a recent study by the National Center for Policy Analysis, a person who committed a serious crime in 1990, the latest year for which complete statistics are available, could expect, listen to this, to spend only 8 days in prison on the average. For the past 3 years, the Dallas-based center has calculated the expected time in prison for committing serious crimes. Expected punishment is the average prison time that will be served, averaging together those who actually go to prison with those who don't. According to the study, a person committing murder in 1990 would expect to spend 1.8 years in prison. For rape, the expected punishment was only 60 days. Expected time in prison was 23 days for robbery, 6.7 days for arson, and 6.4 days for aggravated assault. For stealing a car, a person could expect to spend only a day and a half in prison. From the criminal's point of view, crime definitely pays, says Morgan Reynolds, a Texas A&M University economist who did the study. If you expect to spend only a day and a half in prison for stealing a car, you have to ask whether the car is worth a day and a half of your time. Looked at that way, the wonder is that there aren't more cars stolen, he said. What it really says is that crime, indeed, in this day and age, does pay. A little bit later it says, according to the study, between 1988 and 1990, the expected punishment for murder dropped by 20%. The expected punishment for rape fell by 25%. For arson and robbery, expected time in prison fell by about 50%, and for auto theft, it fell 60%. Potential criminals compare the cost of crime with the benefits, Reynolds says. When the cost goes down, there is more crime, end of quote. In other words, again, crime certainly does pay, at least under our current judicial system. Now, in light of these statistics, some might question whether our current prison system can be rightfully called a penal system. After all, the word penal infers penalization or punishment. And rightfully so, they may question, can it really be called a penal system? Well, let me assure you that our judicial prison system can accurately be called a penal system. It may not penalize the criminal, the perpetrator, or the victimizer. However, it is a system which penalizes or punishes the victim. How? First, by not providing satisfactory justice or restitution for the crimes committed. Second, by not providing sufficient protection from repeat offenders. And third, by making them literally pay for the crime committed against them. Under our current system, who foots the bill for the crimes of the criminal? The taxpayer does he not? Remember the article that inspired this message. It said, Nebraska state prisons held 2,648 inmates as of October 1992. It cost, according to that article, $18,345 to maintain one inmate in a Nebraska prison for 1 year, which equals $48,577,560 each year that the taxpayers have to foot, the bill that they have to foot in order to house all of these prisoners across this state. And that's just in the state of Nebraska. Today, the taxpaying citizen of Nebraska and every other state, are paying double for criminals. We pay by being the victims of their crimes first, and then we pay $48 million per year to keep them in prison while they sit there and do nothing but watch TV. In other words, the victim, who is a part of the general taxpaying populace, is further victimized by the system we're currently under. Why? Well, of course, because they were unfortunate enough to be an enterprising, successful business person. Or because they happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Or for some other innocent reason. You know, why any intelligent, reasoning person can see that the victims certainly deserve further victimization. Well, that has to be the reasoning of those who continue to promote this same system that we're under today. In the current penal system, we also have the problem of nonviolent offenders being housed with violent offenders, resulting in many young, and by the way, mostly white, nonviolent criminals being physically and sexually abused by the hardened violent criminals. Wilmot Robertson, on page 426 of his book, said this, "And as jails become more crowded, they become more insufferable. In most big city prisons, white inmates are now almost totally at the mercy of black criminals, since the latter make up most of the prison population. The homosexual acts and terrorism to which youthful majority prisoners are forced to submit represent one of the most cruel and hideous ordeals in the history of punishment." And then in a footnote on the same page, he documents, he says, "In three Pennsylvania jails, in which Negroes made up 80% of the inmates, there were 2,000 sexual assaults over a two-year period." And I'm sure those were only the ones, obviously only the ones that were reported. Who knows how many there really were. Anyway, 2,000 sexual assaults over a two-year period. Half of these assaults were directed against whites. Time, now keep in mind, that's only 20% of the population were whites. Half of these assaults were directed against whites, as found in Time, September 20th, 1968, on page 48. "Often the only way a young majority member can get by in jail is to debase himself by becoming the punk of a hardened minority criminal who then protects him against gang assaults. In spite of this appalling situation, the Supreme Court upheld a lower court decision forbidding the segregation of prisoners by race to avoid violence," as found in the 1969 World Almanac on page 49. Now, how many of you knew that that was the primary cause of the recent prison riot in Lucasville, Ohio, just a couple, what was it, two, three, 4 months ago? Did you know that was the reason that riot came about? Because they were not segregating the blacks and the whites. Matter of fact, a black Muslim group joined up with a white Anglo group that were usually at war with each other in the prison to fight, to cause that, came together to cause that riot, that prison riot, in order so that they might be segregated. That was the purpose of it. As far back as a year, nearly a year from the time that riot, I believe, was in April, nearly a year before that, I received a letter from an inmate of Lucasville, Ohio. On May 3rd, 1992, here's what he had to say to me in the first part of his letter. He said, this is the first time I heard from him. He said, "Dear Pastor Weiland, my name is such and such, a white man who is presently incarcerated at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville, Ohio. I am a new Christian who is trying to learn and understand Yah's word. I want to be a strong Christian soldier in Yah's army. At the present time, I am being locked down in the prison's local control block because I refuse to share a living cell with a member of the Negro race. I've been locked up for 6 years, and in that time I have watched to my disgust the words and actions of the Negro race in this prison. The white race is to blame for all of their problems, according to the Negroes. I have seen them run in packs like animals, preying on the younger white men for purposes of homosexual activities. I refuse to live with them. I may have to live around them, but not with them. The warden and deputy warden are both Negroes. They tell me I am a racist and threat to security, and until I decide that I will live with a Negro, I will stay locked down. So be it." That was a year before that riot took place. I don't know what I wrote back to Daniel Schreiber, but if anybody would like to write him, if he's even still alive, he certainly may have been one of those who were killed. Being in lockdown, if he was still in lockdown, I suppose he was. I suspect he's still alive. But you may want to write that young man for taking that stand that he did in that regard. In addition to the physical and sexual abuse being rampant as a result of mixing violent and nonviolent criminals together, we also find a fulfillment of what we find Paul writing about in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33, it says, "Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals." Throughout our prison system, they're mixing these two types of people. And I'll guarantee you, you put a non-violent offender or criminal in with a violent criminal, and the violent criminal is not going to be converted to the non-violent criminal's way of life. It's going to be just the opposite. And instead, or as a result, our prisons are simply becoming fertile teaching grounds or training grounds for increased criminal behavior. Just another problem that we find in the prison systems we have today. You know, in no stretch of the wildest imagination have American prisons ever proven to be institutions of rehabilitation. And the extremely rare exception, in some instances, certainly don't make this kind of system a viable choice for crime control in a civilized society. Another problem with our prisons is that in many instances they have simply become slave labor camps. In many of our prisons, inmates are employed at slave labor wages, anywhere from 22 cents to $1.10 an hour, to make boxes, stickers, license plates, mattresses, canned goods, textiles, road signs, and several other things as well, all to be sold on the open market. And all of this without the business owners, in this case, Unicor or the federal government, having to pay, without them having to pay into Social Security, unemployment, workman's comp, health insurance, pensions, or holiday and vacation pays. And they also do not have to pay income tax on their profits. Now, someone may be inclined to respond, and they say, why not? Why shouldn't these criminals at the very least be used in this fashion? Why should they deserve decent wages in light of the crimes they've committed? But that's just how the federal government wants you to think about it, especially a socialistic, communistic type of government like we really have over us today. But you say, what's wrong with it? Well, simply this. It's just another means by which private enterprise is being destroyed. You know, what private businessman is able to compete on the open market against such a setup? You know, selling the same things on the open market, there is absolutely no way that they can compete. And again, free enterprise is slowly being deteriorated through another means. And besides that, it's totally illegal, according to our own laws. Now, that's another story in itself, and will have to maybe be dealt with in more detail in another message. Now, along with these other problems, in many cases, the prison system is now also being used to house a new kind of quote-unquote criminal, those non-government-approved individuals who dare oppose or stand up and take a stand against the current anti-Christ tyrannical form of government that we have. Now, all of these and more portray the many problems inherent in the current prison system that we currently have. But the question, of course, is, what are we going to do about it? Or what is to be done about it? Let me share with you some of the solutions that are being set forth to deal with these problems. Here's an article, a newspaper article called New Prisons, Better Sentencing. This is by Colorado State Representative Matt Jones in 1988. I won't read it all, but let me read part of what his solution is. Here's a man who's made it all the way to the state representative, to be a state representative. If he's made it that far, you'd certainly think that he might have some good solutions to some of the problems. Now, you'd think that if you haven't been around politicians enough to know that they usually don't have any solutions at all. But who knows, maybe this Matt Jones has a solution that might work. Here's what he says. The article, again, is entitled New Prisons, Better Sentencing. He begins, Colorado is experiencing an unprecedented growth in its prison population. At present rates, the number of inmates will more than double from 4,000 to 10,500 by 1995. If the state legislature doesn't address the issue, the backlog in county jails will soar to 6,000 felons within 8 years. A little bit later, he writes, for nonviolent, low-risk offenders, we must utilize more cost-effective alternatives such as increase the number of community corrections, halfway house beds, utilize available jail space by reimbursing counties for their actual cost of incarcerating prisoners. Because the state does not now reimburse adequately, costs are shifted to the county taxpayers. Now, I don't know how he figures that isn't going to still come out of the county taxpayers' pockets anyway, but that's what he promotes. Also, increase intensive supervision probation programs. Now, whose pocket is that going to come out of? A little bit later, he says, we need to build more prisons and to double bunk we need to double bunk prisoners to incarcerate the increased number of high-risk felons. The citizens of the state demand and deserve it. And then lastly, I'll read, he says, one of the most fundamental functions of the state government is to provide for the safety of its citizens. One way to accomplish this is by keeping convicted, violent, and repeat offenders off the street for an appropriate amount of time. In other words, Representative Jones' solution is make more law-abiding citizens pay even more for a system that doesn't work. That's his answers. Now, Representative Jones' answer to the problem was summed up in his last statement that I read, in which, again, he said, one of the most fundamental functions of state government is to provide for the safety of its citizens. One way to accomplish this is by keeping convicted, violent, and repeat offenders off the street for an appropriate amount of time. Now, that statement is interesting in light of what a Colorado resident wrote 4 years later as a result of his package being put into law. In a letter to the Greeley Tribune editor, this particular writer clearly demonstrated that Representative Jones' plan does not work, and at the same time offered the exact opposite as a solution to the same problems. In an article, that being, by the way, put prisoners away for less time rather than more time, which of course was Representative Jones' suggestion. Let me read this letter to the editor by Stan Kearns, entitled Prison Policy Too Costly. It's a little bit lengthy, but you need to hear the whole thing. To the Tribune, April 2nd, the Greeley Kiwanis Club was privileged to hear a program presented by John Capone. Capone operates the Villa Living Center and was seeking to engender public support for his plan to build a prison in Greeley. Parentheses, God help us. He presented some graphs that were fascinating. They showed the following. 1. During the past 12 years, the crime rate in Colorado has been remarkably consistent. During some years, it has been slightly higher. During some years, it has been slightly lower. There has been no pattern to these changes. 2. The rate of violent crime tells the same story, except that it is even more consistent. 3. The prison population in Colorado showed a small increase yearly until 4 years ago. By the way, that's when Colorado Representative Jones wrote his article. The prison population in Colorado showed a small increase yearly until 4 years ago, at which time the, quote, new, tougher, end quote, anti-crime bill, it shot up and now has more than doubled over what prison population was 12 years ago. 4, during the past 12 years, the expenditures for secondary schools have approximately doubled, the expenditures for higher education have approximately doubled, and the expenditures for prisons have increased fourfold. This tells the story. Well-meaning people become convinced that harsher sentences were the key to curbing crime. The prison population was doubled, prison expenditures were quadrupled, and it hasn't had the slightest effect on the rate of crime. The fallacy in this is the fact that most criminals are young. Young people, particularly those from the sort of background that often leads to crime, are not deterred by the threat of prison. What most people don't know is that crime is a young man's business. At 24, a crook is old. At 28, a crook is ancient. And other than a few white-collar types, crooks over 30 are unheard of. As they age, they mellow, they marry, and they get jobs. The threat of prison or the experiences they have there really have little effect on this evolution. Indeed, it is very likely that the prolonged jail terms will make felons even more socially dysfunctional, thus making crime the only possible way of life for them. Gasp of people favoring long sentences will be yes, but at least those people aren't out on the streets committing more crimes. What they forget is that we already had stiff habitual criminal laws, and we have just seen that most people outgrow their criminal years regardless of what we might do to them. The thought of taking these criminal types and locking them up and throwing away the key has more appeal to the typical voter than is probably healthy. I have no quarrel with this person. If locking up crooks give a vicarious thrill to my fellow citizen, then locking them up is fine with me too, if they have the money to do it. But when we see a 400% increase in prison spending with no decrease in crime, then we must choose between what works and what doesn't. If long jail sentences could be shown to produce a more positive effect than educating our children, we might face a hard choice, but it doesn't. Millions of dollars spent building prisons does nothing to deter a child from following a lifestyle that will eventually lead to his being in jail. Spending millions in schools does. I would sincerely hope that we might be willing to give up whatever vicarious thrill locking up crooks gives us and concentrate instead on educating our children. Stan Kearns in Greeley. So, Stan Kearns' solution is, don't spend more money building more prisons and locking up more criminals. Rather spend the money building more schools, which turn out the hoodlums, which by his own admission are primarily responsible for the crime. Another great solution. You know, the solutions provided by these two individuals are simply a form of the solutions always presented by the conservatives and the liberals. The get-tough-on-crime conservatives have produced the lock-them-up-and-throw-away-the-key mentality. Simply put, their solution to the problem is, all we have to do is feed them bread and water and deprive them of everything while we warehouse them until their time is up. Whereas the liberals' perspective of the problem is that people commit crimes because A, they did not have the proper education, or B, they were poor, or C, they were discriminated against. It's, you know, it's the mentality. It's really not their fault. Consequently, they either should not be put in jail at all or be let out sooner. And their solution is simply more tax-funded programs and education. And keep in mind that both solutions end up taking more out of the pockets of the tax-paying populace. Now, interesting, in the editorial that inspired this message, the Star Herald editor stated that these were the only solutions available to Nebraskans. He said, Nebraskans have only three options: build more prisons, send fewer people to prison, or release inmates more quickly. You got the same solutions. Now let's face it, if you are one of those preachers or Christians today who believe that God's laws have been nailed to the cross and are no longer applicable today, then the only options available to you is to rely upon man's solutions to these problems, which are often nothing more than an anti-Christ, anti-Christian agenda, which does nothing but to make more problems. If you've thrown away God's laws, they're right. That's all you have. Now let me ask you, are those the only three options available? Or let me put it to you this way. Do you believe any one of those three options can provide the solutions to the prison problems that I've described to you in this message? Do you believe that any one of those three can provide the answers? Well, I know I'd sucker some of you into it. I do. Not only did this editorial inspire this message, but it also inspired my own letter to the editor back in April, entitled An Alternative Plan for Crime Control. Listen carefully. To the editor, in the Star Herald editorial, April 20th, Seeking Solutions to Prison Crowding, it was stated that Ben Nelson's task force on prison alternatives did nothing to solve the problems of overcrowding in Nebraska's prison system. Surprise, surprise. Actually, it isn't a surprise at all, because basically legislators haven't done anything to solve these problems since the inception of the prison system here in America. Neither have they proved under the present system that they can do anything to effectively put a dent in crime. Our legislators' idea has always been to throw more tax money toward the prison problem. Sure, let's not make the criminals pay for their crimes. Let's make the law-abiding citizen pay for it. In the same editorial, it was stated, quote, to solve such problems, task force members say Nebraskans have only three options, build more prisons, send fewer people to prison, or release inmates more quickly, end quote. Personally, I would vote for number two, send fewer people to prison. As a matter of fact, let's not send any people to prison, and instead resurrect God's plan of crime control. A study of the Old Testament shows that God made no provision for prisons or jails except for the purpose of holding the criminal over for sentencing, which always came very quickly and was carried out immediately. Under God's plan, there was no need for prisons, because either the criminal was put to death in capital crime cases, or he would have to make restitution in non-capital crime cases. Now, someone may counter with the question, what if the criminal won't make restitution? What are we going to do with them then? Well, God had the perfect solution for that as well. Refusal to make restitution, or what could be called contempt of court, was a capital offense. I'll guarantee if people had to choose between the two, they would make restitution. God's plan for criminal control is perfect. Why substitute it with man's fallible ideas, which make only the law-abiding citizens suffer and the government prosper? Indeed, maybe I should say, how about that? I actually agreed with the liberals. Not very often I do so, and of course not really, not when we get right down to it, didn't agree with them too much. We may have begun the same, send fewer people to prison, but of course the applications are radically different when it comes down to what we're suggesting. Now let me biblically prove some of those points, because I didn't use any scriptures in that particular letter to the article. Let me prove to you what I was stating in that article, or at least three or four of the statements. First of all, it's quite difficult to prove my first declaration. That is that a study of the Old Testament shows that God made no provisions for prisons or jails in his plan for crime control. Now, that's a little difficult for me to prove that statement without reading the whole Old Testament to you, and I don't think that you're going to sit still for me to do that, to read all of the Old Testament. However, I can challenge anyone to find me anywhere in the Old Testament where in God's crime control plan there are provisions for jails or prisons. And it simply can't be done. I'll save people the time. You might want to check it out in your concordance, but when you find the word prison being used, it's always, almost always, in reference to somebody else, some other society imprisoning Israelites. It's not God's law plan for the Israelites as he planned it under the Old Covenant. It simply can't be done. Why? Well, simply because a sovereign, omniscient God would never institute an inhumane, unjust, inept system like the one we currently have today. You wouldn't expect that from a sovereign, omniscient God. God's plan, as would be expected, was perfect. And under his plan, only the criminal suffered, and the victim and their relatives saw justice and received restitution. In capital crime cases, which included murder, rape, adultery, homosexuality, bestiality, kidnapping, and several others, the perpetrator was put to death. Plain and simple. In other words, the only prison cell such criminals were entitled to was a coffin. In non-capital crime cases, such as theft, the perpetrator was always required to pay restitution anywhere from 2 to 5 times to the victim. In other words, he wasn't imprisoned either. And the victim wasn't further victimized, and the taxpayer wasn't further burdened, and the prisoner wasn't forced into slave labor. Instead, the criminal did indeed learn crime doesn't pay. It pays under man's system today, but under God's system, crime did not pay. You either were put to death, or you paid 2 to 5 times for whatever you stole or ruined of your neighbor. The punishment indeed became a deterrent to prospective lawbreakers. And again, how anyone could ever say that, at least maybe it's certainly under man's crime control plans, capital punishment and other punishments aren't a deterrent. to crime. But I'll guarantee you, under God's plan, it was a deterrent to crime, even for the thieves. If they realized, hey, if I get caught stealing this one item, I may have to pay, or I get caught stealing one sheep, I may have to pay anywhere from 2 to 5 back, I'll guarantee the thief is going to think twice about it. Or in a capital crime case, when he knew he'd lose his life, you can't tell me it wasn't a deterrent to future crime breakers. But someone is sure to counter, what happens, as I mentioned in my article, what happens if the thief refuses to pay restitution? Well, God had an answer, of course, for that as well. Refusal to carry out the judge's order, or what would have been called contempt of court, was itself a capital crime. Turn to Deuteronomy 17. Deuteronomy 17, verses 12 and 13. It says, "And the man who acts presumptuously by not listening to the priest who stands there to serve Yahweh your God, nor to the judge, that man shall die. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel." And then it says, "Then all the people will hear and be afraid and will not act presumptuously again." Tell you what, you take one sheep thief who is unwilling to follow the judge's order and pay 2, 3, 4, or 5 sheep back to the victim, and all the other sheep thieves are watching on the sidelines, and he says, "I'm not going to do it," and he's put to death. I'll guarantee that there's going to be an exact fulfillment of verse 13, that all the people will hear and be afraid and will not act in such a manner again. Because indeed it will be a deterrent to crime. And also, I'll guarantee, if a thief has a choice of paying 2 to 5 sheep back or paying with his price, I'll guarantee, unless the guy has a suicidal pact with himself, he's going to choose to pay restitution. Plain and simple. And indeed, you can see that, again, it is a perfect plan. It's a perfect system, just as you would expect from our God. Now, some Christians promoting God's laws have erroneously claimed that there is no provision in God's plan for jails or prisons altogether. However, that's not totally accurate. And as I stated in my letter to the editor, in some cases, prisons were used for holding cells while the prisoner was given a hearing or a trial. Turn to Leviticus chapter 24. Leviticus 24 and verses 10 through 12, it says, "Now the son of an Israelite woman, whose father was an Egyptian, went out among the sons of Israel, and the Israelite woman's son and a man of Israel struggled with each other in the camp. And the son of the Israelite woman blasphemed the name and cursed. So they brought him to Moses. Now his mother's name was Shelemeth, the daughter of Debri of the tribe of Dan." Verse 12, "And they put him in custody." Mine has a footnote there. Footnote says prison. "And they put him in prison or custody so that the command of Yahweh might be made clear to them." In other words, the case had to be heard and had to be cited what would be done. Turn to Numbers chapter 15. We find another similar case. Numbers 15, verses 32 through 34. It says, "Now while the sons of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering wood on the Sabbath day. And those who found him gathering wood brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation, and they put him in custody," again footnoted prison, "because it had not been declared what should be done to him." And so indeed there was provision made for prisons and jails, but they were made to be only holding cells until the determination was made on what was to be done with the prisoner, or to determine whether indeed the criminal that was up for trial was indeed guilty. Our current prison system, where imprisonment is used as punishment, did not originate with God. Yes, God did have prisons and jails for holding cells, but they were never intended to be used as a means of punishment. That did not originate with God. Do you want to know where it did originate? Well, here's what Wilmot Robertson had to write on pages 425 and 426 of his book. He said, "Humanitarianism," you might wonder where even humanitarianism came from. They said, "Humanitarianism, which is the extension of familial love to all mankind, was the chief architect of the present-day prison system. Until recently, most civilized countries fined, branded, mutilated, enslaved, or killed their animals." I thought it was interesting that he said, "Until recently, most civilized countries." fined, branded, mutilated, enslaved, or killed their criminals when they did not exile them or organize them into large work gangs. The herding of large numbers of men into vast prison complexes is a relatively new development in criminology. Long prison sentences cause immeasurable psychological damage to inmates by wasting their lives away in useless and profitless pursuits, while the soaring cost of prison upkeep place a heavy financial penalty on those who observe the law. He says it was the result of humanitarianism, that it's a fairly recent development in criminology. Well, I contest that. Generally, I'm in agreement with what he's written there. But I contest the fact that it's a recent development of criminology. In modern times, he's correct. However, our prison system can actually be traced back to an even earlier date, to an ancient culture, which even to this day still has profound influence on ours. Guess where we can trace it back to? Babylon. Turn to Ezra chapter 7 and verse 26. You know, you see how ungodly this system is. For those of us with eyes to see and ears to hear, that's just about what we'd expect. That you'd find this thing originating, or at least being used, as far back as Babylon. In Ezra chapter 7 and verse 26, in a decree from the Babylonian king Artaxerxes, to Ezra, he wrote this statement. He said, "And whoever will not observe the law of your God," this is as he was sending Ezra and many of the Jews there in Babylonian captivity back to Jerusalem. He said, "And whoever will not observe the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be executed upon him strictly, whether for death or for banishment or for confiscation of goods or for imprisonment." Now keep in mind, that wasn't Ezra, and I've seen some of our people interpret that as if that was Ezra's decree. But that was the Babylonian king's decree to Ezra. And note the leavening of God's system with man's system. Nowhere in the Bible can you find that imprisonment was used as punishment under God's system. But here is man's system, the Babylonian system, all of a sudden including it in with things that indeed does come from God's system of crime control. It was a leavening. It's simply been the result of the leavening of the Babylonian teaching, as we've seen it happen in so many other areas as well. Man's system says, build more prisons. God's system says, shut them all down. Actually, I'm in agreement with both the conservatives and the liberals. The liberals say, education is the answer. I agree. Education in God's laws. The conservative legal scholar William Stanmeyer says, we have too much crime and not enough punishment. I agree. Not enough of the right kind of punishment, God's judgments. The liberals say, send fewer to prison. I agree. Let's send none. And Colorado conservative representative Matt Jones says, one of the most fundamental functions of state government is to provide for the safety of its citizens. One way to accomplish this is by keeping convicted, violent, and repeat offenders off the street for an appropriate amount of time. And I agree once again. Let's keep them off the streets forever. God's plan for prisons is shut them all down. In place of our current penal system, let's install God's perfect plan, or at least strive. Let's teach our people the way it should be, and let's strive to install God's plan of crime control. His laws, commandments, statutes, and judgments. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we're very thankful to you again for the opportunity to be in your presence. Father, to be able to be encouraged by our fellowship. Especially be here to remember the death, burial, and resurrection of our Lord and Savior, Yeshua the Christ. Lord, we just ask that you'd also bless, Father, not only these things, but the messages that are preached from this pulpit, especially as they go out across this land, and that they would be the tools that could be used, Father, to educate our people, and indeed we might restore your plan in all areas, including this area, Father, regarding crime control. Crime is indeed rampant. Our prisons are overcrowded. The prisoners are even abused and taken advantage of in spite of, Father, the crimes they've committed. And the victims are even further victimized. Lord, we ask, we know that your plan is indeed perfect, and that indeed, Father, as we turn this world upside down, that it is one of the areas that will have to be reinstated. We ask again that this would be the tool to re-educate our people, that again we might see revival across this land in our taking dominion for the sake of your kingdom. We ask these things now, in and through and by Yeshua the Christ. Amen.